This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by Gingham Auto Driver Restaurant. Are you training for a big fight? Are you an 18-stone bantamweight boxer looking to beat the hell out of a little girl? Did you skip your breakfast of liver and bacon by hiding in a cupboard? Use our trusted nutritional supplement.
For lunch, Ken crouches down beside the road and rubs gravel into his hair.
We're located only a brisk run of 43,000 miles from Kyoto. Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben.
Hello, Nathan.
It is good to be back.
Good. I'm glad to see you again.
On the Mighty Python subdivision of Forest Perspective. Thanks for having me back.
Well, as our co-founder and partner in this grand experiment in discovering whether or not any aspects of Monty Python's Flying Circus still continue to resonate, or whether or not these sketches can hold up to scrutiny, I continue to find it to be a fascinating conversation. I've unplugged my laptop, and I'm going to awkwardly plug it back in.
As you're awkwardly plugging back in your laptop, I will give a shout-out to Keegan-Michael Key. One of us in this podcast interview directed me toward his latest Histories of Comedy 10-part podcast. Who could it be? And Monty Python comes up a number of times as paramount to the way that modern sketch comedy is conceived, delivered, and is actually found humorous. So the ongoing question between you and I is, does it still have legs 50 years later? It definitely has a lot of agreement in the higher-ups of Hollywood comedy.
Interesting. I look forward to the ongoing conversation as to what precisely it has influenced in sketch comedy, what kind of echoes and reverberations, the way in which they structured sketches and thought about humor, how that might have affected people down the road.
Interestingly, it's something you and I have talked about before, where pre-Python, the sketch had a very kind of specific structure where there'd be a setup, a gag, and a punchline, and that would be the end of it. And Monty Python did away with the punchline, getting out of sketches and found transitional elements which didn't really fall into that categorization. And so, according to Keegan-Michael Key, the kind of breaking up of the structure of the sketch is something that Python introduced to great effect and has been recreated as almost now par for the course with modern content. But he credits them as being the first ones to really do it on a grand scale.
That's interesting. I have been poking around at reading a book that was published by the Edinburgh University Press in the end of November in 2020, and which they were kind enough to give me a review copy of in exchange for mentioning on this podcast. So yes, Spawn, not non-Spawn.
All right.
And it's called, and now for something completely different, Critical Approaches to Monty Python. It is a series of different essays by different authors, but the introduction goes a long way into talking about the fundamental grounding of humorous practices that the Pythons were working with up until that point. And the introduction by the editors is interested particularly in differentiating between absurdism, surrealism, and satire, which I bring up particularly because we have talked about satire a lot on this show as being something with a target. We think of it, or I think we have talked about it, and you should feel free to disabuse me of this notion, that satire to us has often been, oh, well, this has to satirize a thing. It's almost like a takeoff, like a Weird Al song, that there has to be a specific thing that's being upended. But the editors of this are really pushing the idea that satire is much looser than that. It doesn't have to necessarily make fun of something, but it does need to come at the idea that you want to point out that something is absurd, particularly if it's rooted in a system or an individual abusing power or being corrupt or ridiculous in some way. And that elevating that and pointing out that absurdity is key. I just have a quote I wanted to read here, which is, "We laugh at human nature when it behaves with machine-like rigidity," which I loved because it made me think both of Eric Idle in the Architect sketch, where he is refusing to acknowledge that the building in front of him is on fire and exploding, and it blinks the word satire on the screen. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a key example of a person behaving as if the circumstances around him are not real. Any real person would acknowledge that, but the humor of the sketch in part is, it's not just a satire of the very specific corruption of architecture, glad handing, and payoffs with masons. It's also saying nobody would act like this. But I also liked that quotation because it highlights something that we bring up all the time in terms of what makes sped up film funny. Well, it makes it funny in part because it's people acting with machine-like rigidity, that the fluidity of movement is taken away when people are sped up. And that's part of what's funny about it.
So I'm trying to parse out why there is a difference between what they said about satire not necessarily having a specific target and square that with how we think of it as being something with a specific target.
Mm.
Is it just that the target could be, instead of something specific like, oh, this building in 1960s England collapsed due to inept structural design, or we're laughing at a person who's just being so obtuse in the face of his ridiculous architectural model?
I think one of the things that elevates Python is it gets to be both of those things. It gets to exist on multiple levels. And so Idle's performance is satirical on one level. And the wider aspect of finding a recent news event where there is corruption and then creating a scenario that shows how idiotic that kind of corruption would be is satire as well. But it doesn't need to. And I say this despite the fact that this is what we do. We provide context. We dig into the history. We say, is this pointed at a specific event, or is this, as we often claim, more of a zany, absurdist perspective? That if it's good satire, it can be grounded in an individual specific current event, but what it's really pointing out is the larger societal injustices that continue.
Yeah, I can get behind that. I think the context of a specific event is sort of the catalyst for roping in your attention and focusing it on the task of the skit at hand. But it needn't be so heavy-handed as to be like, we're talking specifically about the whatever apartment block that collapsed.
Right.
You know, it's just like we're showing it to you, though we're not saying the name specifically. But I mean, in any, say, SNL sketch, they will have, oh, this is Beck Bennett dressed as Mitch McConnell, dressed as Vladimir right. Putin. It's very specific.
And of course, one of the sketches, the sketch shows that does that in England, Spitting Image, that does it with puppets and with impressionists and caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions is, do those people continue into the future enough that they still have shadows and echoes so that when Margaret Thatcher shows up, we know who it is. But when Reginald Mordling shows up, do we have any idea who that is?
Right. Well, that's the shelf life argument we've talked about many times.
Right.
So I don't really think the thesis of the Libraries Association?
Edinburgh University Press.
Edinburgh University Press, God bless them. I'm not quite sure I agree that it's really much different. I still think satire has a specific time constant beyond which it just doesn't really make sense as a element of poking fun at something specific in real life and morphs into more zany madcap humor. I feel like their argument doesn't really change that thesis for me.
I think that's fair. And I think that's one of the marvelous things that we talk about is what has continued to be successful for us devoid of context. That because Python is set in an environment where things are regularly absurd, where things have a tone to them, where, as John Cleese's character starts off this episode by saying,
anything could happen and probably would. So
that expectation of rules can be broken and probably a certain degree of logical coherence from event to event won't exist, that allows us as a younger, more current audience to not need to search for those historical contexts. We can excuse it because it doesn't matter if we don't have it. It just fits within the environment of random things being thrown at the camera.
I want to bring up an example of, to my mind, is probably a satirical sketch which has very long legs. And it's got its hands in both Zany Madcap and satire. This is going to be one of my favorite sketches, so I'm going to just launch into that.
Excellent.
Is the Society for Putting Things on Top of Other Things.
Gentlemen, a prayer silence for the president of the Royal Society for putting things on top of other things.
I do know that in 2021, there exists things like the Royal Astronomical Society, the Royal Physical Society. Things with royal ending with society sounds very British.
Well, it has to have a charter from the crown.
Monarchical, right?
Yes.
And those things do exist now. And of course, they must have existed back 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so probably people thought, oh, they're just poking fun at kind of the ridiculousness of these kind of societies, especially one which is as useless as putting things on top of other things. 50 years later, I watch that. And although there are no royal societies in this country, I assume that that is still a thing that happens in Britain. So I think of it as that's Britain being all British and their stiff upper lippishness. So I can see that it's kind of this poking fun at themselves. Even now, it makes sense. But what they're talking about does seem so bizarre, and the actual feat of putting something on top of something else.
This year, our members have put more things on top of other things than ever before.
I could see the zany madcap humor even in that.
I've never been quite sure. When they say that the Australasian branch
put no fewer than 22 things on top of other things.
All of Australasia. I mean, that's a potentially huge number of people, but in their branch of the society, they've only managed to put 22 things on top of other things in 365 days. Feels like maybe they're setting the bar a little low. I can't tell if that's a joke or not, weirdly enough. But then after that point, once John Cleese's delegate from the Staffordshire branch says,
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's just that most of the members in Staffordshire feel whole thing's a bit silly.
And Graham Chapman dissolves the society forever. That sketch very quickly then jumps all over the place in terms of what it's doing. It goes from a commentary on film versus studio.
Gentlemen, I have bad news. This room is surrounded by film.
What?
It brings in a World War II prison escape pastiche.
We'll get out of this. How? We'll tunnel our way out.
Good thinking, sir. I'll get the horse.
It just brings up ideas and drops them almost instantaneously in terms of, well, what are we doing to get out of this? I don't know. Let's try seven things, which is such a bizarre technique that they abandon their own premise so aggressively that they're more excited to do a bunch of things that aren't connected to the premise than they are in continuing the joke.
I don't really get it. The whole Nazi thing.
Okay.
I understand. Okay, they have a horse. They're probably using it as cover to dig a hole. And then they sing a song. That has never made sense to me. Maybe it's some British thing that I just don't get. Maybe it's from some movie. Maybe it's a historical context that is taught to little British school kids, but not to us Americans.
It's all of those things.
Okay.
There is a true 1943 escape that inspired Eric Williams' book, The Wooden Horse, which was made into a film in 1950. And it was legitimately a thing where in a prison camp, not unlike Stalag 17 or The Great Escape, where two people got underneath a vaulting horse in the grounds of the prison camp and dug a tunnel. They legitimately escaped by pretending to do gymnastics in the yard of a prison camp.
In kind of a Shawshank Redemption-y kind of way.
Yeah, it's absurd that it worked, and it's absurd that they decide that that's how they're going to get out of being on film, is that they're going to conduct a Nazi prison escape in the middle of this episode. And the fact that then, once they've established the premise, and they've established that in order to have the premise, Terry Jones has to be a certain kind of stock character that appears in those films. And that's what satisfies Ian Davison and Terry Gilliam as the prison guards to be able to be like, okay, the genre is complete. We can move on. That then Klee says...
That's the line that he says? The genre is complete?
Well, no, he doesn't say that. I'm interpreting. But he says...
There's a traditionally cheeky, unlovable Cockney sergeant.
And that's when Terry Jones puts his arms around both of them and says...
Dear Fritz, it may never happen. My best regards. Good. Everything seems to be in order.
Okay.
And he's basically fulfilling a film trope of that is shows up in every prison escape movie.
So not quite a satire, but definitely doesn't make me laugh when it comes to its zany madcap humorishness. Okay.
Well, I think what's interesting about it is that the second they've established the premise, they zig away from it. That's when John Cleese runs on screen and says, oh, I found another way out. So let's abandon this entirely and go to a cartoon.
Yes. A very bizarre cartoon. Probably one of Gilliam's weirdest, I think. Only because it does some new techniques where it actually superposes studio action with the actual animation and with the color separation.
Mm-hmm.
A cloth-eared git. And then it's got like a brief episode of the Last Supper with some pretty heretical flamboyant voices. And,
yeah, a really astonishing sacrilegious piece of animation.
Which I had forgotten until I just rewatched it for this podcast. I was like, that's that might be a bridge too far for some people.
The audience's laugh is fun to listen to.
Oh, that bitch, he spilled the entire bottle of Chateau Latour. Everything.
Is it disaster?
Yeah.
It's right after John Cleese has reprised his role as Mr. Praline from The Parrot Shop.
Yes.
Weirdly enough.
Welcome to a new half-hour chat show in which me, Viz the man what's talking to you now, and Blukey, to wit my flatmate, and nothing else, I'd like to emphasize that, discuss current affairs issues of Burning Import.
Have you heard the one about the three nuns in the nudist colony?
Shut up.
And then, as you say, there's a color separation. They separate the screen into half film and half green screen, upon which Gilliam superimposes the animation. And then it cuts to full animation, and you have this marvelous bit of a bitchy fae Last Supper scene that then cuts back after a couple of detours to another World War II reference. Of flying planes, maybe it's World War One. Maybe it's not Stukas. Maybe it's World War One flying aces.
My God, he's coming back!
Of the man trying to escape from film, being trapped in a cloud in a cartoon and being shot at. It's all very bizarre, but that's the through line of the episode. There are two through lines. It's a stream of consciousness of John Cleese commenting.
Well, they seem to be in another tight spot.
From the gorilla mat, but also of these gentlemen trying to get out of the show.
Maybe it would make more sense to me if I could recognize what is the costume that this sort of old-timey military robot that they're walking in. I mean, at one point, all five of the British members of Monty Python are as little cutouts being cast through a vast plumbing system into a person's stomach, out through a gorilla's mouth. They fall eventually into some, it looks like, I would just say Civil War general with some medals on his chest, and they form that it's a robot, and they walk around, and he's met with another robot.
Yeah, it's basically a combination of Rock'em Sock'em robots and like a Voltron mecha.
And I have no idea who it is, And they say,
"So, British pig, we meet again."
What?
So I'm kind of lost as to who it is, and maybe that would make it more entertaining for me if I could identify who it is on the screen. Who is the character they're walking around as? And maybe not.
Well,
to me, I just
I'll
find
tell
it
you that Daryl Larson did identify the two characters.
Oh, yes, the great Professor Larson.
And I didn't write it down because it didn't help me enjoy it. Like, it didn't add anything to me. I think you're, by the way, you are correct, if I recall correctly, in identifying that it was a Civil War uniform. But reading the names meant nothing to me. And so I didn't bother writing them down because it didn't give me any particular more insight into the idea as to why a French general mecha would be rock'em sock'em roboting the dinner club ex-members hiding out in the Civil War mecha. I think it really is just Gilliam being surreal, just having fun. To cut to another cartoon that happens soon after that, where you have Nettie and Teddy talking to each other.
I say, Teddy, you said something, Nettie. That's right, I did, Teddy. Well, what is it, Nettie?
With the voices of Graham Chapman and Michael Palin as these two very rotund, bizarre gentlemen talking to each other about piggy banks and wanting to hunt them down. And as each one talks, a very unprecedented, disconnected piece of animation gets put on top of their heads and then disappears in sequence back and forth. There's an owl and a tree and it doesn't make any sense. I found myself howling with laughter the second or third time I was rewatching this for the podcast. The first time I remember sitting there going, yep, don't know what you're doing there, Terry. I'm not sure this adds to it. And then the third time, it added to it. Like, it was just, it was so much. It was just doing it in order to have something else going on. And it really made me happy.
Now, the Teddy and Nettie, that is a linking segment.
Yes.
But the one before with the World War I ace, World War II pilot, Luftwaffe, I don't know, gunning the people down from the cloud, they just cut straight to John Cleese back at the Gorilla Mat.
Correct.
So they gave him, Terry Gilliam, you can do whatever you want. And maybe that's just because, oh, I have no confines. I don't have to bookend this and have it pushed to the next scene. I can get it, have it be as weird as I want. Bring in The Last Supper, bring in a mistaken suicide. To me, watching it again, maybe I haven't watched it enough times to get that sort of like, oh, yes, this is telling me something funny. It just seems weird to me. And so because it was so weird, I forgot about it until just rewatching it now. Mm.
One of the things that Cleese says when he cuts back to him at the Gorilla Mat is, boy, they sure seem to have gotten themselves into trouble again. So that's the only real connection between the two runners in the show, is Cleese doing his incredibly awkward, desperate attempts to be funny commentary and failing miserably, and the fact that he's commenting on the runner of them trying to get out of whatever trouble they've gotten into, because it tends to cut to him whenever we've gotten back to the Supper Club escapees in their animations. So they will get to a place and then it will cut back to him. It'll say,
well, they seem to have linked that themselves. So there's no need for me to interrupt at all.
You know, as if it's a serial within the show.
Now is a good time as any to say that the number two favorite sketch is Cleese's announcer from the Gorilla Mat snack bar.
I'm fascinated. I say this regularly in our episodes where you will bring up one of your top three sketches and I'll go, wow, wouldn't have chosen that one. Nathan, wow, wouldn't have chosen that one. I'm going to later, probably in the show, bring up the Seven Brides for Seven Brothers sketch, which I consider to be an absolute masterclass in anti-humor, in that it's so bad and not funny that it's astonishingly funny. Whereas I think Cleese is doing the same thing in this episode, and it doesn't work for me at all.
Well, we've had the dessert, and then... And so... The first item, the last item on our menu of fun is coffee.
Like, I can see the technical aspects of his awkward performance, but cringe humor leaves me so cold that I can't really relate to somebody being like, oh yeah, Cleese's sad sack announcer in this episode. That's one of my top three bits.
Now, I should specify, it is the entire arc stitched together. He appears maybe five times, but stitched together, that is the whole sketch that I like.
Yes.
So it is a Cleese that we don't see that often. Usually he's crazy mad maniacal or he's over the top supercilious. But this is one who is very mousy and unconfident. Mm-hmm. And I like that novelty to it. Here's a guy who is clearly in over his head. Like, he's given this gig to announce the BBC show, and he's got a couple of jokes written down on a 3x5 card in front of him. And he is not doing well, and he knows it. In that kind of laugh through my nose, I find that hilarious. And you stretch that all the way through where he's having kind of very negative interactions with the staff at the Grillomat. And his final sort of farewell is...
I'm more of a visual performer. I have a very funny walk. I wish I'd been in that show.
I could have done it. If only they give me... No, they're not going to give me another chance. It's just hilarious. It's a self-referential callback where he fails. I like that.
I will point out that the audience agrees with you because the ending of the show is him on the top of a double-decker bus lamenting about the fact that he has failed and probably won't be back introducing the show anymore. In fact, so much so that when I first watched this 20 years ago, I had known vaguely that Cleese didn't come back at some point over the courses of the different series. And I wondered, like, was this Cleese's final appearance before he stopped being part of the troupe? Like, it had that kind of terrible, self-pitying aspect to it that I wondered if he'd written himself, they don't think I'm funny, I'm going off and doing Fawlty Towers, you can all go screw sketch. Like, it's very, it's meta on all kinds of different levels in that there is this weird other dynamic of Cleese becoming increasingly dissatisfied with being part of the show and feeling like they're repeating themselves and they're not pushing boundaries and not wanting to come back and eventually not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of wondered if this was... It, obviously, it's not. He shows up for a whole nother series, and this is in the middle of this series. So I was just flat out wrong. But it was weird to wonder that at the time.
Hmm.
But my point was is that the audience, he says,
I wish it had said the end.
It cuts to the end. The audience applauds. The live studio audience thinks that this is wonderful. They think the sketch is brilliant. They think his depressed performance is brilliant. I'm the only person that doesn't.
Okay. Let me see if I have anything else I can say about this.
Was there anything else about his performance? I was reminded of his performance in It's the Arts at the very beginning. I think he's channeling the same kind of the way in which he talked to Eddie Baby is that same kind of sniveling desperation.
I don't feel It's the Arts. He's desperate. He's just coming at the argument or at the interview with a kind of perverted starting point.
Hmm.
I think in the Grillomat, he realizes I've got to make this work. This is my whole career is resting in this. I'm going to make it work. I'm going to make it work. Camera turns on. Oh my God, this is going to fail. Oh my God, my life is over. He realizes that, and he has a very difficult time dealing with that.
Mm.
So then little things start to set him off, and it's fun to see the unraveling of that character. So to me, they're not quite the same. I feel like the guy who talks to Sir Edward Ross knows that this is the show that he has been running for the past 5 years, and he's going to have a career doing these interviews for another 5, 10 years. But the guy in the Grillomat is like, all right, this is my one chance, my one step up to the wickets. I'm not going to screw this up.
It's like that Far Side cartoon of the orchestra and the guy playing cymbals. I won't screw up. I won't screw up. I won't screw up. And he's only got one cymbal in one hand and the other one's not there.
That's exactly right. Anyhow, that's what I have to say. I think that is my second favorite sketch.
All right, let's plunge merrily on to number three.
Number three, Ken Clean Air System.
This is Ken Clean Air System, the great white hope of the British boxing world. After 3 fights and only 2 convictions, his manager believes that Ken is now ready to face the giant American.
Ken Clean Air System is a fascinating escalation of the traditional Palin Jones faux documentary sketch that has been the end point of so many episodes up until this point, where you have a very long, and this is about 8 minutes long, so slightly shorter than, say, for example,
Ethel the Frog.
Ethel the Frog, or going way back to the very beginning, the funniest joke in the world.
Right.
But that same format of we're going to have an extended sequence of one narrative, but we're going to pepper it with tiny little jokes in the middle. It is, I think, more absurdist than those other ones. It has more tiny surreal moments and less connective tissue than the other two.
Mm.
But maybe I was thinking specifically about the Piranha Brothers and whether or not that had an equal amount of we're just going to throw jokes at the wall, and if they don't work, then it's too bad because we've moved on to the next one, sort of airplane style-y.
Hmm. I think the Ken Clean Air System sketch is more of a physical comedy review than the Piranha Brothers is far more narrative and talking.
Excellent point.
Like the jokes are more jokes that you would just say and you'd listen to. But things like, why is it Engelbert Humperdinck? I don't understand, but...
The great thing about Ken is that he's almost totally stupid.
He's in a car talking and the car just doesn't stop and he's on a very long lens. Why is that? I find that funny. Why is Lady Air Vent on top of a cab as she drives away? That's so tight focus you don't tell until it drives away. That's funny. Why does Ken clean us up and why can't he run around a parked car? These are all physical humor bits, which it does two things. It shakes up that format of faux documentary from being mostly talking heads, as in Ethel the Frog, to more physical comedy bits, which just it tickles a different funny bone for me and probably for a lot of viewers. The second thing is physical comedy has a much, I would say, shorter fuse, so it doesn't last as long, which is why the sketch doesn't go on for that much longer after he starts fighting Connie Booth in the ring. Because once that's done, that's it. There's no more you can really do with that. They even push the joke of getting him out of bed a little bit too long.
Hello. When Ken is in a really deep sleep like this one, the only way to wake him up is to saw his head off.
But a lot of like where the camera is and what you're seeing is funny. So the example I love is his coach kicking him out at 8:30 in the morning. The camera stays on his coach and his wife. Ken runs off the screen. The wife and the coach look at each other and then run back inside. They're going in to have an affair. I find that physical comedy.
So Larson makes a point in his commentary on this episode that the moment that I referred to earlier of Ken for lunch.
For lunch, Ken crouches down beside the road and rubs gravel into his hair.
Right.
He says that this bit of surreality is less funny because it's both saying it in the voiceover and showing it. He says that if we had seen Ken training and running along and the voiceover had said, for lunch, Ken stops and rubs gravel in his hair, and it was just a joke that wasn't connected to the visual narrative, or if we'd seen him do it, but it hadn't been given the additional caption, that it's the rough equivalent of early Superman comics, where you have a caption that says, Superman grabs the villain and hoists him up on top of a telephone pole. And then the picture is Superman jumping up to hang a guy on a telephone pole. And then the guy is saying, don't hang me on that telephone pole, Superman. Like, it does it three times just in case you didn't get the point.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a lack of trust in the audience. And I was wondering what your response to that was, because I'm interested in the way in which you say that Ethel the Frog was largely verbal, and that this part, because it's often the way they've filmed it and not narrated it, that that's one of the few examples where they do both at the same time.
I did not say that rubbing gravel into his hair was one of the high points for me. So yeah, the showing it and telling it, not as interesting. But him running and he can't get around a parked car, it's just there on screen. There's no audio to back that up. It's funnier.
And I think it's the biggest laugh of the sketch. I think that's where the audience finds it the funniest. Just the extended amount of time of Cleese standing, staring dumbfounded at the back of a car, being like, what do I do?
It's a great physical comedy bit. And it's not that other... How do I want to say this? They have used physical comedy a lot in the past, but in the format of these documentaries, it was a high point.
I want to talk a little bit about the ending, because I found that John Cleese with his extraordinarily long arms being able to clobber the petite Connie Booth in her blue dress and pigtails and just knocking her down, done in sped up footage so that you get the additional comic absurdity of that. I didn't find it as funny as I might have done in the past. That there was just something about a grown man beating up a frilly girl that maybe in 2021 isn't that silly anymore. It's it reeks of potential violence in a real way. Or maybe it's me not being able to divorce myself from the current political climate and just be like, hey, Russell, it's okay. You can have things be silly. And this is clearly not realistic. They're doing everything in their power to show you that it's not realistic. And therefore, you can forgive it. It's not actually an example of espousing violence.
Obviously, boxing must have its limits. But providing they're both perfectly fit, I can see nothing wrong with one healthy man beating the living daylights out of a little schoolgirl. It's quick and it's fun.
But for whatever reason, it didn't particularly sit well with me.
Hmm.
It didn't seem to bother you this time around? Didn't affect you?
I don't find it the funniest part of the sketch.
Okay.
But it doesn't bother me as, espousing the standpoint. It's okay to abuse children. I don't really think of it like that.
I don't know. I think, on the one hand, it's a perfectly good structural comic reversal because we've introduced Petula Wilcox sitting there knitting, listening to her Cliff Richard music.
How does she rate her chances against Kenny?
Well, I'm a southpaw, and I think this will confuse him, particularly with his brain problem.
The fact that she's so wrong, and that what really matters is being 6'4" and being able to have a longer reach, and nothing else matters. And the fact that he's 180 pounds, which is very much not bantamweight, which I believe taps out at 109, something like that. It's 18 stone. I'm sorry, not 180 pounds. 18 stone he's listed as, which is 252 pounds, and therefore much heavier than the 112 to 119 bantamweight qualifications. Thank you, Daryl Larson. The fundamental reality of it comes home to roost, that she thought that she might have a chance to confuse him, but you just can't escape the physical realities of it. I kind of think that that's a bit of a letdown. Like, I would have preferred it to have been she won. If she had knocked him down in fast speed-up motion, it might have been funnier to me, because it would have been that extra mile of absurdism, and I don't need him to be the hero. There's a sketch that's going to come up in the future called the Undertaker sketch, where a man brings in his mother to be buried, and the BBC found it in such bad taste that the only way they could get it filmed and on the air was if they included the caveat of the audience getting so upset with the sketch that they rushed the stage and ended it out of sheer disgust that the sketch existed in the first place. In this sketch, you have the voiceover as Connie Booth is getting pummeled by her then husband, where you have somebody, I think it's Terry Jones, say, providing it's a clean fight, I'm perfectly okay with a grown man beating the hell out of a little schoolgirl. Basically being like, as long as everyone's following the rules, then this kind of violence is perfectly acceptable. That feels similarly like they needed to have that kind of comment in there in order to make it okay. They needed to have it be a satire on boxing in general, much in the way in which Terry Jones's mother says,
"He was so kind and gentle, really considerate to his mother, and not at all the kind of person you'd expect to pulverize their opponent into a bloody mass of flesh and raw bone."
I feel like this conversation's gone where I didn't expect it to go.
Interesting.
Hmm.
What did you think I was going to bring up?
I didn't know. That's, that does not go through my mind when I write down these favorite sketches.
Fair point.
Or, I mean, a lot of this is predicated on the end, which I had sort of forgot about until you just brought it up.
Truth be told.
And when you were talking about maybe Petula Wilcox will in one fell swoop land a left right on his temple and knock him out, would have been equally funny to me, but they just didn't do it that way.
That's right. And you can't second guess that sort of thing.
Right.
You have to judge the episode as it shows up 50 years ago, as opposed to what you wish it were.
Right.
And there's no reason for me to use you in that sentence when I'm clearly admonishing myself.
It's good to see Connie Booth on the screen.
It is. I believe it's only her second appearance.
She was in the I'm a Lumberjack song.
Right.
Maybe that's all she was in, if I think back. But, I mean, I loved her in Fawlty Towers.
Right.
I know her and Cleese had... We're not too long after this divorced, so they two split up and she kind of got out of acting. But I think it's good to have her be in the Monty Python series because it reminds me, yes, another American can be part of British humor. Carol Cleveland, who was born in America, wasn't she? Was she not?
That's what I recall.
And she grew up in England from a young enough age that she has a British accent, where the same is not true for Connie Booth, who was in America until she was, I guess, a 20-something before she met Cleese. But we digress. I want to ask you a question. This has nothing to do with anything we've talked about so far.
Hit me.
What is
but
the
But not
deal?
The way in which John Cleese was hitting his wife.
But I'm a southpaw.
I won't see it coming.
Not through this video call. Mm. What is the deal with the joke?
Quickly, run this way. If we could run that way.
And then having the person shush them.
Sorry.
Because it has happened so far, to my account, in this series three times. I think the middle time, maybe because the shows were broadcast out of order.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like some aftershaves, please. Walk this way. Well, if I could walk that way, I wouldn't need aftershave. He says the end of the line.
Yes.
And it gets a little bit of a laugh. This is the second time in the Society for Putting Things on Top of Other Things. If we could run that way, and then he shushes them.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens one other time.
Oh, it happened. I'm sorry. It happens
in the Deja Vu.
Yes, it does. It happens on the way to the dairy.
What is the deal with that joke? Because in the Society for Putting Things on Top of Other Things, the laugh is pretty tepid from the audience.
Mm.
And maybe it's because it's the sort of clumsy, everyone trying to say a thing at the same time, and it comes up as sort of a muddled, sorry. I don't quite get this joke. I mean, I understand that it's meant to be sort of a feeble attempt at wordplay. I don't know. What do you have to say about that? What does Mr. Larson have to say about this?
Larson, to my knowledge, doesn't trace it to a particular source of a meme in society at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't attribute it to, everybody knows this joke because it was in the Carry On films.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like the kind of thing that would have been in the Carry On films. The basic idea of... I mean, what's the version of that joke? Walk this way, please. And the person walks across a floor and the other person also exaggeratedly swings his hips in a way in which somebody else wouldn't.
Like Young Frankenstein.
Correct. Which I believe is 75. But it shows you the length of that kind of joke. And if Mel Brooks is doing it, there's a strong possibility that it goes so far back to vaudeville or to that kind of era of joke. I find that Brooks used a lot of vaudeville and Catskills humor as the basis for his callbacks. And of course, the Pythons are referring back to a lot of traditional jokes from the music hall stages. And so these are probably 50 to 100-year-old jokes that are just part of the culture. And they're bringing them up in part because they're just that dumb. It's the equivalent of take my wife, please, or I just flew in from the coast and boy, are my arms tired. Like, you say the joke because it's not funny anymore is how I've always taken it.
It is always used so far in Python as a button to the end of a scene or scene segment.
Because
in the chemist sketch, it's Terry Jones who says, certainly, sir, I walk this way. And then Idle says, if I could walk that way, I would need aftershave. And then police comes in and pulls away Eric Idle. And then it cuts to a different chemist sketch with Michael Palin behind the...
Because that was too naughty. Yeah, that was the not-so-naughty chemists. But because he's bringing in sexual innuendo of walking that way, he needs to be bum-rushed off the stage in order to have a completely not naughty chemist.
Okay, question asked, answer given. Let us move on.
Well, let us move on, therefore, to the Monty Python Minute. where we are going to use the ineffable services of the good people at random.org to pick 1 minute out of the episode, and then Nathan is going to watch the minute, and if he's able to summarize those 60 seconds in a mere 30 seconds, then he will have a bonus point as we move into the subsequent quiz that will be sourced by something that took place during that slice of Pythonania. And our minute this week, I have no idea what it is. Because my notebook is all out of order, as which is why you've heard pages flipping constantly throughout this episode. The good people at random.org have assigned you, Nathan, minute number 5. That's minute number 5.
I myself, on my way here this evening, saw a thing that was not on top of another thing in any way.
Shame!
Shame,
shame.
Shame indeed.
Okay.
Are you ready, sir?
Adroitly.
Your 30 seconds begins now.
Graham Chapman is leading a group of men known as the Society for Putting Things on top of Other Things, and he implores them not to be despondent because there are things still not on top of other things, but the Australasian branch has put 22 things, no fewer than 22 things on top of other things, and they are flourishing. But you have to talk about the Staffordshire branch. They have not done too well.
10 seconds
people
left.
Are congratulating themselves, smoking cigars, patting themselves in the back with every single one of them has a big mustache. Staffordshire branch, what are you doing? And that's when it cuts out.
Time! Look at that! Lean and efficient. You are Ken Clean Air Systems of the 30-second summary set.
Yeah, well, you know.
Getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning in order to go back to bed and train later sure is doing wonders for you.
Yeah, you laugh, but that is kind of what I have to do to feed my son, so.
All right, Nathan, well.
Anywho.
Because the Royal Society for Putting Things on Top of Other Things was the focus of this minute, I'm going to begin by asking you 5 questions about stacking things. Question number 1. Once a traditional Chinese practice, egg balancing and egg stackings have taken off as an activity and are both monitored by the Guinness Book of World Records. We've already spoken of Muhammad Mukbel of Kuala Lumpur, who was able to stack 3 eggs on top of each other.
Indeed.
One of these other stacking records has not been ratified by the Guinness Record Book and is false. Which of these 4 does not exist? A. Don Ahey of Bridgeport, Ohio, stacked 9 golf balls vertically. B. Shen Jianxi of Beijing, China, stacked 11 bowling balls. C. Deepak Sehgal of India stacked 253 1-rupee coins on the edge of a 5-rupee coin. Or D. Did Silvio Saba of Rodana, Milan, balance 4 M&Ms on top of each other? One of those is untrue.
I would say stacking the M&Ms is not true.
Unfortunately, B, 11 bowling balls is untrue. He only stacked 10 successfully, but the 11th one knocked them over. Question number 2. The tallest stack of pancakes was made in Rufford, Newark in the United Kingdom in 2016 by Messrs. Hayward and Nichols. How impressive was the stack? A, it was 101 pancakes, measuring 2 feet, 2.4 inches tall. B, 213 pancakes, measuring 3 feet 4 inches tall. C, it was 242 pancakes, measuring 5 feet 10 inches tall. Or D, trick question, it wasn't pancakes, they were crepes, and it was a 5-foot stack of 604.
Let's just say crepes.
Ah, you fell into my trap. Mathematically, the crepes one makes sense, which is because I worked it out mathematically. But no, the proper answer is B. It was 213 pancakes, measuring only, to my mind, surprisingly, 3 feet 4 inches for 213 pancakes.
Well, for anyone who makes pancakes, depending on how much water you add, they can be very thin.
I think that based on the photograph, which you can take a look at on Guinness and on a number of news sources, the gentlemen involved were interested in making very stable, very dense pancakes so that they could use them as stacking bricks.
Good old British pancakes.
Question number three. One of the most popular ways to put things on top of other things is with Lego. In fact, if one was to build towers of the entirety of the over 400 billion Lego bricks that have been manufactured in its history, it would be just under 2,400,000 miles in length. Now that is the rough equivalent of A, building a stick to push away asteroid 523934, open parentheses, 1999 FF14, close parentheses, that approached Earth in 2019. B, a physical trail marking the 6-day orbit of Sally Ride and John Fabian in the Challenger in June 1983. Or C, 10 towers that would bridge the distance between the Earth and the Moon.
Well, the distance between the Earth and the Moon is... Would you say that the actual length was 2 million, like 2.4 million miles?
Yes. Yep.
I think... C, let's go with the Moon.
Correct. The other ones were roughly 2.5 million, but yes, 2.4 million is...
Wow, okay. This is like fine precision math here.
I love the fact that you had the distance between the Earth and the Moon in your head well enough that you were able to estimate that that would be close.
I would love to be able to say that I got that from college, but in fact I got it from watching Parks and Rec.
It's as good a source as any.
Yes, they go.
Question number four. On the podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish, it has been commented many times that Prince Charles was a fan of the Goon Show. What society or fan group did they claim that Queen Elizabeth wanted to join, but was told it wasn't appropriate? A, the Melba Opera Trust, set up to encourage emerging Australian opera singers and named after Dame Nellie Melba, who died in 1933. B, the Royal Seville Marmalade Society, which sets the standards for European marmalade quality, but which the Queen was recommended to resign from during political difficulties surrounding the Rock of Gibraltar in 1967. Or C, the George Formby Society, dedicated to the comic ukulele player, famous for his semi-ribald song, When I'm Cleaning Windows.
I'm pretty sure after watching the Kin speech that the Queen is a marmalade lover, so I'm going to go with B.
It's not B. There is a Royal Seville Marmalade Society, but she was a huge fan of George Formby and was very disappointed when her advisors told her that it wouldn't be on form for her to join a fan society for a man who sung slightly dirty songs, even though she could sing all the lyrics herself.
Okay.
And last, which of the following is not a bizarre society? A, the UK Roundabout Appreciation Society, which believes that straight roads lead to unsightly boredom. B, the Swan Quill Society, a calligraphic club that only uses pens made from the natural hollow of swan feathers. Or C, the Prince Philip Movement, a religious sect dating back to the 1950s, which believes that the Duke of Edinburgh is a divine being. One of those three is made up by my fevered brain.
My God, I really hope A is not a society. I'm going to go with A.
Nope, it's the swan thing.
No way. Oh. Look, I like roundabouts too, but... But come on, you can't have an appreciation society.
Well, I think they are just as solidly believable as the society for putting things on top of other things.
Case in point. That's satire, people.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I got 1 out of 5. Look at that.
But you got the bonus, which means you got 2 out of 5.
I don't win.
Which, according to our modern education system, means that you need to go into recovery, and we need a tier 2 intervention in order to make sure that you can demonstrate your competencies and skills.
All right. Ben, let us discuss our top 5 moments. A moment in this podcast is, of course, a small bit of film, studio, acting, cartoon, joke, facial tic, what have you. It just makes Ben and I chuckle and smile. Ben, number one on your list, please.
Well, I've mentioned this briefly, so let's get to the heart of how much I love the Seven Brides for Seven Brothers sketch.
Sir, 'tis time you and your six brothers were married.
Thank you, Headmaster.
Indeed.
And it would be hard for me to single out one particular moment. I find every aspect of the performances in that to be wonderful. How awkward they are. We talked previously about when the Pythons played little kids being interviewed by John Cleese outside of school, how good they were at it. This is that same sort of thing. But I gotta say, the final moment of the sketch where Michael Palin as the school vicar comes in and says,
"Do you four boys take these two girls to be your seven brides?"
Yes,
right, go and do your prep.
Like, that's the end of the play. It's so dumb. But Palin's delivery is so natural, so effortless. He does this little thing with his glasses that he must have seen real people do all the time, the way in which, like, when he's talking down to a boy, you sort of take your glasses off for effect. Everything about it is a pristine piece of realistic recreation of what it must have been like to be in those terrible boarding schools. And they all do really good jobs of playing their parts. But I think that Palin bridges that gap between dramatic acting, effective recreation, and ludicrous delivery that sums up the heart of why I think that sketch is wonderful.
It's funny. I always thought that line was "go and do your crap," which to me is far more humorous, but I get now it's prep. All right.
What do you got for me as part of your five?
Prawn salad.
Prawn salad?
Cut.
This one was fascinating to me. I'm glad you bring it up. So, first of all, I love the subsequent sketch. I love the whole thing of Eric Idle being in a house that falls down around his ears. It's a wonderful piece of escalation. But the fact that it's a transition of Cleese saying prawn salad and then cutting to a piece on a door that says Prawn Salad Limited is such a strange transition on lots of levels. So I believe it's Pixley who tells me that that sketch was originally filmed and intended to be in series one, episode 10, which means that him saying prawn salad, that doesn't make any sense, is true because it wasn't part of the original continuity. And so I went back and looked at what sketches were in episode 10. Now, Pixley loves to number sketches by production order instead of broadcast order.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely sure what sketch he's talking about. But in episode 8 of the first series, that's where you have the Notlaw Bolton stuff. And that's where a number of different things are listed as something, something limited.
Mm-hmm.
And so it feels like Prawn Salad Limited is the logical extension of one of the runners in that episode.
Hmm.
And that's the only connection I can make as to why it would have been part of the film in the first place.
This is an open ask to any of the surviving Pythons to please send us an email through firstperspective.com. Chime in.
Pixley has a lot of access to the original production files. And so he's good at being able to see where things were originally filmed and when, and therefore where things might have been originally placed. But as a non sequitur, I agree with you that it's lovely. Much like Mr. Belpit showing up again in this episode.
Oh, Mr. Belpit! You live so soon!
Excuse me, is that the school hall? I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm not in this one.
And then never showing up again, despite the fact that he says he thinks he's going to be in the next episode. These are strange artifacts of intention that we just love because they turn into nonsense and they don't have to resolve themselves.
So this series, just like series one, has a 2-week gap between episodes 3 and episode 4. So it'd make more sense if this is between episode 4 and episode 5, which is what it was in series 1. But they have a 2-week gap.
Right.
I do remember when we were recording the podcast for series 1, it was kind of a question as, did they do that because they thought that the show was going to be canceled? I think BBC had that intention, but then massive fan response brought it back.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely writing to that effect in their Pythons on Pythons biography. It seems weird that they would have that same thing happen for series two, where it's got more legs and much more traction in the viewing British public. And so maybe they would have had to scrounge around to put together an episode after the two-week gap, so it sort of feels more mishmashy. But I'm totally just talking off cuff. I have no idea if this is actually true.
Mm. Well, I can tell you that it was recorded on the 10th of September, and then it was broadcast, as you say, on the 27th. So there was time in between the studio bits, and obviously the filming had happened months before that. So the editing would have taken place and the fixing of different elements. I think they had a lot of time to judge where they thought things should fall. But having not looked at the Radio Times archives to see what aired during those weeks in the middle, I don't know if it was, say, the proms or something that happened every year. And so it would have been like the equivalent of you have to rearrange your calendar for sweeps week or the Super Bowl or something where you don't have a choice. You just don't get to broadcast those weeks.
Well, unknown. Again, any Pythons who are surviving, please let us know. So third favorite moment. You're up.
I'm going to say during the blackmail sketch, there is a particular moment I love where Michael Palin leans forward and says,
£3,000, please, to stop us revealing your name, the name of the three other people involved, the youth organization to which they belonged, and the shop where you bought the equipment.
And he has this particular glee in his delivery there. Like, he's really happy at the possibility that this could ruin a man's life. And despite the fact that later in the sketch he says, we don't morally censure, we just want the money. The way in which he's so excited to be like, oh, we've got this guy to the tune of £3,000, which, by the way, is roughly the equivalent of $57,000 in today's money. That's pretty, he's really fun in that moment, just how excited he is that we're going to be able to stick it to this guy. I think in general, his performance during that sketch is a lot of fun. Palin has said in interviews and his memoirs that he kept the jacket and wore it at home for his wife on occasion, which I find ridiculous. But that particular line delivery, I find a lot of fun.
Speaking of line deliveries.
Yeah, hit me.
This is a sketch we have not talked about. It is the, I guess, butcher shop sketch.
Good morning, I'd care to purchase a chicken, please.
Don't come here with that posh talk, you nasty stuck-up twit.
I beg your pardon?
A chicken, sir, certainly. Here
Thank
we are.
You.
Hmm, yeah.
It's a great, tight, very funny, very simple, stupid sketch. What is it now, you great pillock? Is a great line. We have talked about kind of PG-13 rated insults that are come from the high word on the SAT study guide. A book coming from Python, pillock is probably not there, but it's still a great word to use because nobody really knows what it means in this country, in America, a pillock. You sort of get the context, but I love it.
Yeah, it's good. You mentioned earlier what John Cleese's Mr. Praline calls his roommate, where he calls him a cottonhead, which I think is also a great incel. Basically, you're calling somebody the tip of a cotton swab, which is great. Like you're a soft, absorbent, disposable piece of nonsense.
So, Ben, your fifth moment.
Well, I'll just say, in rewatching this episode, I found the sketch that we just mentioned earlier after Prawn Salad, when Eric Idle's character goes into Prawn Salad Limited and everything falls apart around him.
Yeah.
It came off the wall.
Yes, sir?
It just came right off the wall.
Really, sir?
Yes.
It's such a basic, elementary sketch. One of the things that comes up in the University of Edinburgh book is that one of the commentators, Wilmot, in his book From Fringe to Flying Circus, says that what he believes was established in the satire boom of comedy sketches is what he calls the escalation sketch. And this sketch is a prime example of escalation, where things start and then get worse and worse and worse and worse over the course. And you sort of think it's over when Eric Idle says,
I won't wait. I'll phone.
And then it escalates even further, twice, where he's trying to escape out of the house while everything's blowing up around him. And then when he shuts the door and it cuts to the footage of the cabin exploding, it's so dumb. It's so dumb. And yet I found myself helpless with laughter. I knew it was coming. And yet I don't know why. It's such an ordinary slapstick cut. And I absolutely adore it. And I just wanted to single out, apparently in the script, there's a bit where somebody refers to the idea that this footage is out there. Very basic premise of like, the stock footage of the house exploding. Gilliam will find it. It's fine. it's fun that they had that image in mind. Like, they knew somebody had seen it. Terry Jones had seen it. They knew it was mythically out there, and they're like, that's what will end the sketch. And now our production monkeys have to go and find it in the BBC archives and put it together. There's something wonderful about that, that it's basically pre-memeing to a degree, where the punchline exists out in the world, and you write a sketch to a thing that someone else is going to has already made for you. Not dissimilar to the, are you just going to show me films all night in the end of the sex scene? You know, that where they're writing to a gag of this footage exists. We just need to compile it in the right way. There's something very interesting about that thought process of the humor is bringing the audience to a thing that you love and you want to share with them.
Probably not a meme, though, because people probably would not have recognized that specific house exploding.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe it's, especially if...
it's an asset.
Yes. And yeah, perhaps
I don't mean
not.
To like but, finger yeah. wag at you.
But it's no, I get it. A meme would be the Wilhelm scream.
Yes.
People who write scenes knowing, oh, we're going to be able to put the Wilhelm scream in there. That's memification. That's saying, I know that there's a thing out there that people will recognize and will get a chance to use it. Mm-hmm. Whereas you're right. If their commentary was, it's out there someplace, somebody needs to find it, then it's not a real meme. You're right. But it is the idea of there's a thing that exists and we're going to write our sketch to that thing is an interesting thought process, and especially that it works. It's such tight editing, it's such good timing, and it just knocks me over with a feather.
Cool. This Python Perspective sub-episode of Farced Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
Editing was done mostly by Ben. You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @farstnamebasis. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the context and lasting power of comedy. In this case, the comedic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, names, dates, facts, cuts of meat, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the Royal Common Conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
Have you heard the one about the three nuns in the nudist colony?
We'll see you next time when we discuss episode... 6. It's a Living or School Prizes.
Right. Got to have an alternate title when you don't have real titles.